Well, this morning we return to our studies in the letters of the Apostle Paul, and we are presently in the book of 1 Corinthians and the 7th chapter. And this 7th chapter is something of a transition in that it seems to take up the matters about which the Corinthians wrote. Now, that certainly would seem to be true with regard to chapter 7. These are matters contained in the letter the Corinthians had written to Paul, where they had raised questions. And some think that the phrase "now concerning," whenever you find it, those are matters that Paul is sort of like going through the letter or making a little checklist. Well, they asked about this, they asked about that, they asked about the next thing. Then he checks those things off. But also in the context where you have a lot of now concerning, you have it in chapter 8, now concerning the things offered to idols, you have it concerning now concerning the spiritual gifts in chapter 12, you have it now concerning with respect to the offering in chapter 16 that Paul was taking up amongst the Gentile churches for the benefit of the Christians in Jerusalem. And then you have a now concerning that also is another one in the letter, which I can't recall what it's about, maybe travel plans, something like that. Anyway, it may be these are matters that are taken up, these are the things that are in the letter that they wrote to him, but certainly we know chapter 7 is. And you know, when you look at the content of chapter 7, so much of it is ambiguous, so much of it you just wish you had that letter that they had sent to Paul, so you would know for certain what their concerns were. I mean, Paul knew what their concerns were. The Corinthians knew what their concerns were. But we as readers in the 21st century can only guess at some of those things. But yet the instruction, I think, is important and it's rich. And again, I think we have to pay attention to the different changes in focus. It begins with the words, "It is good for a man not to touch a woman or to have sexual relations with a woman," and a lot of the modern translations would make it out to be, because that's what he's talking about. He's talking about sexual relations, but the woman, the word woman in the Greek, can either be a woman in general or a wife. He could be talking about immoral relationships, or he could be talking about conjugal relationships within a marriage. A lot of people think, and the ESV is one translation that sees it as a quote, quoting the letter that they wrote to him. It's not something that Paul himself was thinking. It's a slogan. We saw that there are these Corinthian slogans, things that were commonplaces amongst the Corinthians that Paul has to challenge. And this whole question of their thinking, that it's good for a man not to have a woman, is that, as Christians, it's probably best, even for married people, just to live a celibate life, just to live an ascetic sort of life. It's a strange thing. You have the warnings about people going to prostitutes in chapter 6, and a man that has his father's wife, you have that kind of licentious abuse and going in the direction of casting all care to the wind, everything's lawful. And now you're moving into the fact that there are others in the church who were moving in the direction of asceticism, thinking it's best to serve Christ by not having the concerns of a marriage relationship. And Paul is addressing that, and he's countering that. And he says that it's good for a man not to have sexual relations. I'm sorry, that's the quote. He says, because of sexual temptations, sexual immorality, each man should have, and that doesn't mean he should marry a new marriage, it means he should possess his own wife, and each woman possess her own husband. So in the first section, he's talking to married people. He's talking to married people about their responsibilities to one another within the framework of the marriage relationship, that they're not to use sex as a tool to get something. It's something they owe to one another. Husband doesn't have power over his, the woman doesn't have power over her body, but the husband, and the husband doesn't have power over his own body, but the wife. And you see something of equality that's going on here of husband-wife relationships. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. That there's some mutuality that's going on here. And we need to take that into account. Whatever we make of role relationships in the Bible, Clearly, in these matters, there's clear equality. That what Paul says to the husband, he says to the wife, and what he says to the wife, he says to the husband. There's a couple of exceptions, but only a couple. But he goes through this section, really moving in the direction of just seeing in the marriage relationship, it's a partnership. It's companionship. It's something that you each party has responsibilities. And certainly with regard to the sexual relation, they have responsibilities to one another, except if there's a mutual agreement for a limited time to devote yourself to prayer and then to come back together, that you might not be tempted, that Satan might not get an advantage because of sexual temptation. Now, Paul is writing as from the perspective of a man who does not presently have a wife. He likely had a wife. Usually men who come to prominence in the Jewish religion, which he said that was his story, that he was an up-and-coming star in the Jewish faith, that married men served on the Sanhedrin. Married men had places of authority as rabbis and teachers. And so Paul likely had a wife, but at this point he doesn't have a wife, and I don't think he abandoned a wife. I think that she probably died. Again, we don't know it, but that's the most likely scenario. But he's now a man who doesn't have the burden. I shouldn't say the burden. He didn't have the responsibilities of a wife or children, and he's free to travel as he was doing. And Paul sees great benefit in this. And so he says, now is a concession, not a command. He's making this clear. He says, I wish that all men were as I myself am in verse 6, but yet each has his own gift from God. This whole question of celibacy is a question of, has God gifted you for it? And Jesus mentions that there are those that are made eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of God. But it's something that not everybody is called to. And you shouldn't try to be what you're not if you haven't been given a gift from God. A wife is also a gift from God. A husband is also a gift from God. But to live a celibate life is also a gift from God. Each one has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried, he addresses the unmarried in verse 8. It's good for them to remain single, as I am, but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it's better to marry than to burn. That's God's answer to legitimate sexual desire, to have a partner and have the ability to enjoy the gift of sex in the framework of the marriage relationship. And then he goes back to addressing the married once more in verse 10. And he makes a distinction between things that are charges that are that the Lord is giving and things that he himself is giving. To the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. Here's something that is clearly from the very mouth of Jesus, I think, when he walked upon the earth. Jesus gave instruction about divorce. It should not be. It was not so from the beginning. He that made them male and female, he that made them in the beginning made them male and female and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cling to his wife or cleave to his wife, be joined to his wife, and the two shall be made one flesh. And Jesus says, what God has joined together, therefore let not man put asunder. Now, in the Gospels, there is an exception that's given. It's not found in Mark and Luke, but it's found in Matthew. Again, Mark and Luke are giving it as it was from the beginning, straight out. There was no sin in the Garden of Eden. There was no adultery prior to sin entering into the world. It was only man and woman. There wouldn't be other things that entered into it. But that's God's design. Two shall be made one flesh. And the adulteration of marriage is something subsequent to sin entering into the world. And with respect to sin entering to the world and the problems of sexual immorality, and the problems, the things that lead to divorce, Moses gave some instruction to limit the evil fruits that came from a divorce. He, Deuteronomy chapter 24, Moses says he just can't be giving the wife a bill of divorcement and looking to take her back at your whim. You really have to think this through. And he gives regulations with respect to the practice of divorce. And I think in the context of, again, the sinful world in which we live, it was to limit or mitigate some of the most bitter fruits of marital discord. And so when the Pharisees and the scribes are arguing, and they did, about divorce, you've all seen Fiddler on the Roof, right? There's a scene in the synagogue, and they're arguing, and one of the men says, "You mean he can divorce her if she burnt his toast?" And that's the position that the more liberal wing of Judaism, the school of Hillel, said that a man could divorce his wife for any cause. Now, Moses didn't say that. He found some impurity in her, some uncleanness in her. Now, he doesn't define what that is, but it's not just for any cause that you give her a bill of divorcement and send her backing. No. And Jesus goes further and says, it was not so from the beginning. Moses permitted you to divorce. He didn't command you to divorce. It's not a command, but it was a permission that Moses gave. And the reason for it is not very flattering to you religious leaders. It was for the hardness of your hearts. Again, the people of Israel were hard of heart and stiff of neck. And that was the basic majority report of the people that were in covenant with God in the Old Covenant. And the regulations that God gives that today we would look at and say, that shouldn't be. Christians don't do that. They don't engage in polygamy. The kings of Israel were allowed to do it, and others were allowed to do it for the hardness of your heart. God permitted you. He never commanded it. But there are those things that the law tries to restrain the evil in these sinful practices that take place in a fallen world. And so Paul's gone back to as it was in the garden. He doesn't mention the problem of divorce because of sexual immorality, but there is a permission that's given for the sake of sexual immorality in Matthew chapter 5 and also in Matthew chapter 19. But the instructions that Paul gives is from the Lord, things he taught in the life of he lived upon this earth, the instruction he gave when he was with his disciples in the flesh. The wife should not separate from her husband. But Paul does give not a permission for divorce for sexual immorality, but he does give to the woman the right to separate. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, in verse 10, she should remain unmarried. Now, I guess the separation that is in view there may be looking towards formalizing it in divorce if you're going to take another husband, but that's the story with her. She needs to remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And then he says the husband should not divorce his wife. This is one of the places where permission is given to the woman to separate, and doesn't seem he's repeating that with regard to the man. It just says the man should not divorce his wife. That's interesting, isn't it? Why would it be in the context of an epistle where Paul is really balancing this, saying that this is mutual? What's good for the man is also good for the woman. Here there is a permission given to the woman to separate and remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And he doesn't repeat that to the husband. He doesn't say, well, the husband should not divorce his wife, but if he does or gets separated from her, also he should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her. What do you think is behind that? Any ideas? Yes, Tim.
Well, it could be, looking back, that it was this one man who had his father's wife, or in that sense, that this maybe was more prone for the men to you know, engage in sexual immorality than women? Or could it be possibly from the fact that a man should be more apt to be violent with his wife?
Yeah, I mean, when you really think about it, because of, at least certainly in biblical times, less so today in our culture, it's pretty much a patriarchal society that Paul is addressing, when the man is king of his castle and the man is the one making the decisions. He holds the property. There were some liberties in the Roman Empire that allowed some women to have more rights and liberties, but in a Hebrew situation, it was the man, generally speaking, that put away the woman. I know today in Judaism, the woman could also do it. Get the get, it's called, the legal paper that says that religiously she's divorced. But that doesn't seem to be the biblical picture. The biblical picture was most of the stuff has to do with the man. And the man, really, in many ways, especially in a patriarchal society, does determine the temperature, the climate, the ethos, the atmosphere. There's all synonyms of what a marriage relationship is like. Now, again, the sins of a woman can also... But it's generally speaking, a woman could have a mental illness and lead lots of things into chaos in a family. But generally speaking, it's the attitude of the husband, even towards a woman who has a mental illness, loving her, caring for her, bowing to her needs, doing the self-sacrificial things that husbands ought to be doing, that will calm many of the storms. Generally speaking, most of the troubles is men who are demanding, men who are abusive, men who are violent. And, you know, the man doesn't really have an excuse for those things. And certainly give him the excuse to leave the marriage because he's mad, he's angry. No. He has a responsibility to humble himself before God and the wife he sinned against and get reconciled to her. But if she's been the victim of a lot of that, I think the church has some responsibility to say, your life is important and your safety is important, and we think if you desire to leave, great, we got about 15 families that'll take you in. But you can't get married. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to leave the marriage or leave the home for the purposes of humbling the man. I don't know how many times I've gotten phone calls from men who have said, I need to talk to you, my wife just left me. Now, they would never come and talk to me when their wife is in the home. They're ruling the roost. They have the wife in subjection, or at least in fear, and they have the four walls that surround them and nobody looks in, and now the wife leaves and finds a safe home somewhere. And now the guy wants to talk. He wants to negotiate. He wants to do anything to get her back. And usually to get her back means is to abuse her more. But the point is, the woman who leaves and has the permission by the apostle to leave for the purposes of safety, for the purposes of getting out of a bad situation, is putting pressure upon the man to humble himself and probably work with the pastors and reform, change. And to reconcile means he's committed to do things differently, you would think. You can't reconcile where there's still abuse and abusive thoughts and abusive words and I have the right and all the rest that tends to go on in relationships. So I think that's something of the reason. At least that's how I use this passage all my ministry. It's basically to say, well, if you think you're in danger, you ought to leave him. And we'll see what we can do to support that and to help you. There's a lot of times women do not leave abusive relationships because they have no place to go. Now the church should provide them with places to go. or at least the ability to get the county's resources in on it and to support her in the safe home or whatever it is that would be decided upon as to how she could make this separation to put pressure upon the man to amend his ways. That's the purpose of it. So it should be with the view to reconciling upon reformation. Okay, does that make sense? Paul gives that permission to the woman, but not to the man. It's the man, he's the one who needs to set the climate of the home so that the wife is secure and safe and has no reason to leave. Tim.
Yeah, just on the other end of that too, it's not like the wife can stay until the woman or the man like to leave, because in other parts it says, you know, if you're living with an unbelieving husband or wife, you just stay with them.
But he also gives the permission if the other party's unwilling. But that's a different story. Here we're just talking about the marriage relationship in general. Again, I think if there's abuse on the part of an unbelieving husband to a wife, these verses would apply to that. But I don't think there's ever the thought you have to stick it out. We had a guy on the radio years ago that Mr. Camping, some of you remember him, and he would tell women, "Fear not him who is able to kill the body, and after that has nothing to do to you. Rather fear him who's able to cast both soul and body in hell." So be willing to die in an abusive relationship. I'm going to beat you to death. Don't fear it. You're going to heaven when you die. That's true. If you're a believer, you'll go to heaven when you die. But I don't think anybody should desire you to hasten the timing of leaving heaven, leaving this earth to go to heaven because you've had an abusive husband that's beaten you to death. I think the church has a moral responsibility to protect an abusive wife. I abominate that teaching, and it found its way into the church because of people who listened to Mr. Camping, and every word he said was gospel to them. Anyway, there are others that teach the same thing in the church today, and I just think it's just lacking in the compassion that the gospel calls us to. It's abusive. It's the church becoming abusive, saying the man has the right to do that to a woman. No, he does not. That's not biblical headship. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And well, anyway, so I do see that Paul gives the permission to the woman to separate. Again, with a view, God willing, to see reconciliation upon reformation. And then Paul says, to the rest I say, and here it's not I, I'm sorry, it is I, in verse 12, but he says, not the Lord. Now, does that mean this is teaching that Jesus doesn't support? Is there some wedge of distinction and division between Paul and Jesus and his apostle? Well, I think the expression is simply, here's a matter that Jesus never addressed when he was upon the earth. And remember, he said, many things I have to say to you, but you can't bear them now. But he's going to give the Spirit who will lead his people into all truth. Well, again, there's instruction that comes through the Spirit, giving light and understanding to the servants of the gospel, particularly the apostles. And in their letters, they give instruction, and this is something that now Jesus never legislated about. And Paul's aware of that. I think Paul knew the gospel tradition. And I don't know if any of the gospels are written at the point when Paul's writing the 1 Corinthian letter. Most people think the gospels were just a little bit later. But he knows the gospel traditions. He knows the things that were said about Jesus' public ministry. He knew it well. And he says the Lord never gave any instruction about this, but this is my instruction to you as a Spirit-filled apostle of the Lord Jesus Christ. He says, if any brother has a wife who's an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. It shouldn't be that you say, well, now, she's not a Christian, and therefore that's reason enough to divorce her. No, it's not reason enough to divorce her. The marriage is still valid. That whole instruction in 2 Corinthians about not being equally yoked together with unbelievers, that has to do with things you enter into now. But if you've already entered into a marriage, it's a marriage. I mean, God gave marriage to mankind, not just Christian, the Christian segment of mankind. Marriage is his institution for human happiness. And that's something we should, first of all, see it is for our happiness as Christians and try to get that message out into the world. That God's design is superior to what you're doing. You're following a pattern of life that's ultimately self-destructive, destroying one another in so many ways. And it's sad. It's sad where people are left. Just going from relationship to relationship to relationship to relationship, shacking up with one person, shacking up with another. That this whole idea of marriage that God has given us in his word is actually something for the good. The designer gave us the design, and marriage is part of it. And if you are a brother who has a wife, and she's an unbeliever, you're not to divorce her. You're not to take the action to put her away in any way. If a woman also has a husband who is an unbeliever, and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. And then Paul says something interesting here. He says, for the unbelieving husband is made holy because of the wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. I say it's kind of a strange thing for the Apostle Paul to say, because the Apostle Paul is a Jew well aware of Judaism and Judaistic customs. And was it ever the case in the Old Testament that something became holy if something holy touched it? Usually it's the other way around, isn't it? It's the transference of the unclean thing that makes people unclean. That's the whole instruction in the book of Leviticus, that seminal discharges or bodily discharges or blood can make things unclean. A dead body can make things unclean. Infections or skin eruptions can make things unclean. Moldy houses can make things unclean. And there were purification rites to cleanse that which was made unclean by things that touched things that were unclean. Holiness was a matter that only God can give. And yet here there is the making holy or sanctifying an unbelieving spouse. Rather strange for the Apostle Paul to say something like that. Now, I think it's important to say what he's not saying. There's really no reason to think that Paul is saying that this sanctifying thing that Paul's talking about, he doesn't open it up and explain exactly what he means. There's no reason to believe that that means that that unbelieving spouse, because of a relationship with the husband or wife, should therefore become a baptized member of the church. I don't think that follows from this matter of holiness. He's talking about the family now. He's talking about marriages. And he's talking about a sanctification of the unbelieving partner that continuation in a marriage will bring. He doesn't then say, well, let's bring it over into the church and make the unbeliever a baptized member of the church. Maybe we'll hold communion from them, but they can still be considered Christians and still be considered members of the church, though they visit the local pagan temple and bring their offerings and do the pagan thing. And yet because of a believing marriage partner, they should become part of the church when they're not married to Christ. when there's no faith, commitment, the relationship to Christ? I mean, it would seem like there's no grounds to believe that any sort of thing like that should happen. And that would also be true of the sense in which the sanctification or holiness is a matter that pertains to children. When he says, otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. Again, it's not just the kids that are holy, it's the spouse, the unbelieving spouse that's holy. And just as you would not baptize an unbelieving spouse, why would you baptize a child? Because they have this holiness that here is being spoken of. Again, this holiness does not mean conversion. Although, if that happened, they wouldn't be unbelieving. They'd be believing. This is a holiness that is relational. That has to do with influence. It has to do with the fact that when people come into the church where the holy people of God meet, there is something of an influence we impart to them. It's not saving, but it's maybe making some impact or impression, because we're the light of the world, we're the salt of the earth, we're to be making an impact upon other people by the gospel we teach, by the way we live. And people can come into the Church of Christ or into your home as a Christian and see an orderliness in your life, see the children are being loved and children are loving their parents, and so that's really interesting. This doesn't seem like the normal American family where everything is total chaos and people are screaming at the top of their lungs at one another and everybody's bearing a grudge and everybody's just on the threshold of just a temper tantrum. And this seems to be a well-disciplined, well-ordered home. How did that come about? And again, if your home was not that way and you're a Christian, I'm not going to say shame on you. I'm saying that's the potential we have as Christians to really make a difference. When I was early on in my marriage, I worked at a place that was owned by a Christian owner who liked to hire Christian people. But he also had relatives of some of the Christian people he knew that weren't Christians, and he would hire them too. And so sometimes you just had to hire people that, I guess, worked their way into the place by merit. I don't know how it all happened. There's even a real big preponderance of Christian people or relatives of Christian people. But every now and again, there was somebody that had no such relation to anyone who was a Christian. And I remember one of these guys who was taken on as an employee. We were together, and he said, you know, this is a really interesting place. I've never worked in a place where, and when people go on breaks for 15 minutes, they get back in 15 minutes. Usually when most places, you milk it for all the time that you can have. But people seem to have a conscience there. If it was a 15-minute break, you got back at the end of 15 minutes. People were living conscientiously. And the impact of that reality was seen. This is not the normal workplace I've ever worked in before. People seem cheerful. People seem respectful. You don't hear a lot of cursing going on. And I had the privilege of telling him, well, you know, the owner is a believer in Jesus Christ, and he hires a lot of Christians, and I think the reason you see what you see is because of the transforming power of Christ and his gospel. And that was an open door of opportunity to witness, because this guy came into a business where Christians were, where he was exposed to the holy things. And there was a sanctifying influence that got him to ask questions about the gospel. Imagine if you had to have that 24/7. Because you're married and living with somebody. Not 24/7, but you know, most of your life is spent, you're sleeping with somebody who's a Christian, who's acting in Christian ways, thinking Christian thoughts, speaking Christian words that are influenced and impacted by the gospel. And you have everyday evangelism going on. And Peter says as much in the book of 1 Peter chapter 3. I don't think he's saying anything much different when Paul's saying in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. How that verse ever got to be a reason to baptize children, I just don't know. Or to admit people into the church just because they're married to a Christian. when they're not themselves believers. Again, I just don't know. But here you have in 1 Peter chapter 3, he says, "Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word," that's the husbands who are not Christians, "they're not obeying the word. You wives, be subject to your unbelieving husbands." So, and again, it's a patriarchal society that was expected in a wife. The gospel should not cause a revolution in unbelieving people's homes. Again, I think the idea of the Christian marriage is tends in the direction more of partnership, more of the sense of companionship. I mean, I think there are clear roles that are assigned, but you don't strut around saying, "It's my role to be head, it's my role to, you know, you submit to me." No, you're told to love, not to tell her to submit what her role is. You carry out your role of loving. Loving your wife as Christ loved the church. That sacrificial love that Christ has to his church, you to demonstrate to your wife. Not strut around your headship. And so the wives to an unbelieving husband in this sort of society, this is the proper counsel to be giving. And particularly it's counsel to be given. He says, even if some do not obey the word, and they've heard the gospel, they've rejected it, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. You know, it begins to open up their minds. Well, you know, I didn't like it when you started to hang around with those kooky Christians, but man, it seems like she's been a better wife. It seems like she's a better human being. It seems like this gospel she professes, maybe there's something to it. They may be won without a word, just observing the conduct of the wife. I think it's in that sense you have this sanctifying influence in the marriage relationship that a believer could have to an unbeliever. And that should be a mission in the part, if a person's married to an unbeliever, that should be their mission. I want to so honor Christ in the midst of this marriage that he will become a Christian. She will become a Christian. They'll come to know the Lord. I don't want to put obstructions in the way. I want to live out a Christian life faithfully and consistently so that they may see what the gospel does. That this gospel of transformation we talk about is not just talk. It's something that people indeed experience and do manifest in the sight of other people. So that's the main reason Paul says, you're not to just say, well, they're unbelievers, so let's just put them away and look for a believer to marry. But he does give an exception. Just as Matthew gives an exception to Jesus' teaching with respect to divorce because of sexual immorality or uncleanness, Paul gives what's called, sometimes called the Pauline permission. The Pauline permission. But if the unbelieving partner separates, they pack up and go. Let it be so. They want to quit on the marriage because you're a Christian. Don't fight them. Don't fight them. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved or not bound. Bound to the marriage, bound to the relationship. God has called you to peace. Try to leave on the most peaceable terms, have them leave on the most peaceable terms possible. If he calls up and says, I left some things in the study, don't just say, well, I'm just throwing them to trash. Try to do it on the best terms possible, because God's called us to peace in this thing. Don't war with an unbelieving husband. Again, put the things of the gospel at the forefront of your concern to be an ambassador for Christ, to be a missionary in your own home. And then Paul gives the same argument that Peter does in 1 Peter. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? in other words, be the means to their salvation. Be that constant reminder of the reality of Jesus and the gospel, because they're living with you. How do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? And so that's Paul's instruction to the people married to unbelievers. Any questions about any of this instruction up to this point? Now Paul begins to go into some just general principles that's sort of informing his viewpoint or his approach to this whole question of marriage. Sometimes we make marriage the most important thing. I think, I don't know how many people I've met who became Christians, and this think of first order in their minds is, I have to find a Christian wife. Or I have to get a Christian husband. That's the most important thing. This marriage is the most important thing. Well, there's no question marriage is important, but it's not the most important thing. And far more important is you grow as a Christian. You become a suitable marriage partner by learning the ways of Christ. Be, you know, especially if you've come from a real wretched background, you know, which I did as a youth. And, you know, I tell you today, as a pastor, if I was counseling me back then, I would say, you're not eligible to marry. You're just too immature. And you just have too many things that you need to address in your own life before you bring a woman into those problems that you have. You wonder why my wife is so saintly. She has to live with me for all those years until, well, hopefully I've learned some new ways. Hopefully, I'm a late bloomer, but I'm hopefully getting there. But you know, you understand my point is this matters of first importance. And matters of first importance is not finding a marriage partner. But so growing as a Christian, you might be a worthy marriage partner or certainly qualified to enter into the marital state. And so Paul says, only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. I don't teach anything different anywhere else. I want people right where they are to begin to apply the gospel to their life situation right where they are. And don't say, well, if my condition changes, then my Christian life will change. And it's often said when people move around a lot from job to job and place to place and city to city, wherever you go, you're taking your own problems with you. You're going. If I could leave me behind and take up some other identity somewhere else and have a new disposition about all things, that'd be wonderful, but that doesn't happen. Wherever you go, you bring yourself. And if you're not mature enough or growing in the grace of the gospel sufficiently as an unmarried person, don't think marriage is going to become a blessing to the marriage partner that you're proposing to enter into marriage with. You're just taking your own cursed life, in the sense, and bringing her into it, or your own troubled life. And you're bringing another person into it. So, lead the life that God's assigned to you, to which God has called you. Was anyone at the time, and here he goes into three different things. He goes into circumcision, and then he goes into slavery. And of course, he's been speaking about marriage up to this point. So you have, and these things having to do with circumcision and slavery are meant to illustrate what he's talking about when he's talking to the people about marriage. This is illustrative, but it's informative as well. He says, was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. I don't know exactly how that would be done, but I think more literally, let him not seek to be uncircumcised. And of course, Paul knows that physically speaking, that's an impossibility. But the point is, circumcision is a mark of one's Jewishness. It's a mark of taking upon yourself the yoke of the law of Moses. So if you were called and you were uncircumcised, don't try to live as a Jew. Again, this would be particularly pertinent in Jerusalem, because many of believers were... First, addressing the circumcised first. Don't look to just assimilate with a Gentile situation and lose all the marks of your Jewishness. If it was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised, let him not seek circumcision. In other words, circumcision or uncircumcision are not the important thing. Verse 19, for neither circumcision counts for anything, nor uncircumcision, but the keeping of the commandments of God. Now, I know some people, not so much from a Gentile background, but from a Jewish background, when they became Christians, they became influenced by people that are into the Jewish Messianic movement. And even though they were raised pretty much as assimilated Jews, as I was in New York, they became more Jewish than they ever were before. They took on Jewish names, they began to keep Jewish holidays, all things they never did in Judaism, but now they became a Christian, and now they're trying to be more Jewish than anyone. And I know some of it is for the sake of looking to tell your Jewish friends or family that Christianity actually is Jewish. I understand that. But there are things more important than Jew-Gentile distinctions. It's a new creation, Paul says in Galatians. That's the most important thing. Showing forth the power of a new creation, the keeping of the commandments of God, the loving God and the loving neighbor. These are the things, folks, that we are mainly called to. It's a whole question of how you see yourself, how you see your identity. Is your identity the identity of a Jew or a Gentile first? No. It should be that of a Christian. It should be that of someone who is in union with Christ. That your identity is to be centered in Christ. And these other things are matters of small potatoes. Paul says there are times he lived as a Jew because he wanted to win the Jews. There were times he lived as one without the law, as a Gentile, because he wanted to win those who were without the law. All things he did was for the sake of the gospel. So these human distinctions... I mean, I realize Jewish and Gentile is also something God ordained because he called the Jews to be his own special people. But now, in the gospel, it's not the most important thing. Just as marriage or not being married is not the most crucial thing. It has a place of importance, but not primary importance. He says in verse 20, each one should remain in the condition in which he were called. And here's where we get into some trouble with respect to the whole slavery question in terms of our modern American context and this ancient context and just what Paul's about here. Paul says, were you a bond slave? Were you held in bondage? Were you the property of another person? Was that your condition when you were called? He said, do not be concerned about it. I mean, you think of the genius of the gospel. Christ calls us to freedom. For freedom, Christ has set us free, he says in Galatians chapter 5. Freedom from the curse of the law. Freedom from... the power of sin. We have been brought to be free from all the things that have held us back from honoring and serving God. But now you're a bond slave. What does that mean for church attendance? You can't make your own decision. And you begin to get antsy. Well, maybe I should just run away. Maybe I should do what Onesimus did. We met Paul, became a Christian, and now Paul's sending him back to Philemon. And Paul writes the letter to Philemon just on that backdrop. I mean, Paul's point here is that Just as marriage is not the ultimate concern, and circumcision, being a Jew and being a Gentile, is not the most important sense of who we are and what our identity is, even with respect to being in bondage, being a slave, that's not the most important thing. He that was called as the Lord, in the Lord, verse 22, as a bondservant, is the free man of the Lord. You've been liberated from a far greater bondage than the bondage to your earthly master. You're in bondage to sin. You're in bondage to the world. You're in bondage to the flesh. You're in bondage to the devil. And you've been liberated. And even though there are hindrances that servitude places upon someone in terms of the service of God, a bond slave could not decide. Paul, I hear you going to head from Ephesus back to Corinth. I'd like to go with you. Bond slave doesn't have the freedom to do that. He's under servitude to someone else. But Paul says that he says there's a parenthetical statement after he says, "Don't be concerned about it," is if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. If God in His providence opens up a door of liberation, that's wonderful. That's great, because you know that's far more natural, that people shouldn't be held in bond service to other people. Now, let me just back away here and just say something about this whole question of the biblical position with regard to slavery versus our own American situation with regard to the slavery of the African peoples in the South and the islands of the West Indies, the whole British slave trade, and then the American slave trade, and treating people as if they were things. In biblical slavery, what you have in the Old Testament, it was always for a time. There was always the year of liberation, every seventh year, the time of the 50th year as well, the liberation day, the Jubilee, when the slaves were free. And even at such conditions, I mean, there were things that were legislated that are offensive to us today. And again, I think those slavery commands and rules and regulations is another species of the sort of thing that God was doing with respect to the marriage institution, is that slavery is not something natural to the human condition as created from the hand of God, for one man to own another person. I mean, the sort of moral stuff that goes on, even in the best situations, is altogether so wretched, altogether so dehumanizing. And the very fact that God in the Old Testament came to a captive people in the sort of in the same, and it's interesting that the black people in America took the Exodus as the hope they had of God visiting them as He visited the Israelites and leading them out of bondage into freedom. But that's the God we serve, the God who in Leviticus said, He redeemed them from the house of the bondage of Egypt, that you might stand erect. You might no longer be under the burden of somebody with a lash, or somebody putting upon you the quota of the things you had to produce, or else you'd get the lash. That's dehumanizing. And God called that nation out of that kind of servitude, that kind of anguish, that kind of misery that slavery brings. And God says, I'll bring you out to the wilderness that you might serve me. And I'll raise you up. You walk erect, as you were meant to walk. Not as a thing, but as a human being made in the image and in the likeness of God. And though I don't think Paul in the epistles is looking to say, well, now the gospel comes as a revolutionary thing in the Roman Empire that will somehow change slavery within the next 5, 6, or 7 years. First of all, it was so ingrained, that was not happening. That was not happening. But Paul so addresses the gospel to people that when he writes to a slave owner by the name of Philemon about a runaway slave Onesimus, he tells him to treat him not as a servant, but a brother. So that's what he's become. He's believing, and he's a brother. That's one of the lines of O Holy Night. The slave becomes a brother. Now, it's hard to think of a brother as someone whom you're going to make unrealistic demands of, who you're going to treat harshly, who you're going to treat just threatening with the whip and bringing the whip down upon his back. No. The gospel is a gospel that reconciles. And so the whole genius of the gospel is that when it takes effect in the hearts and the lives of people, eventually, just as polygamy became a thing of the past, because of the ideal of the union of one man and one woman, when the grace of God takes hold of people's hearts, we're not going to opt for a society in which slavery is something we could easily adjust to or think it's perfectly okay. And we could see a bunch of people joining us who are held in bondage and slave and chains in the back of the church. And you know, you have churches even here. You go to Hogenberg Road, is it? What is it?
New Hurley Reformed.
New Hurley Reformed, yeah. I think there's another one also that I've seen where they actually have the places where the slaves were, the chains where they were hooked when they came into worship. Because of slavery in the North, back in the early parts of the 17th century, slavery had not been fully eradicated even in the North. And you know, that's not consistent with the gospel. It just does not comport with the gospel. So you have to wonder the Christianity in which that sort of idea is just made second nature. But you know, in order to make it second nature, you had to say somebody's inferior. You had to say we are superior. You had to say that you have no rights and you're not even. And you know, that attitude was held. That this is just an inferior race that needs the paternalistic guidance and government and whippings of a superior race. And again, I don't think Paul would have been happy with that if that attitude came into any church. And we should not be happy when attitudes, and it even exists today, where there are people that want to see the South rise again and the way of even justifying Southern slavery among Christians today. Some of these guys have gone back and read the old Southern Presbyterians and the Southern Baptists who wrote these very impressive tracts about the biblical nature of slavery. See, the South thought they were fighting God's battle. God's institution was the institution of slavery. They saw it in the Bible. They didn't see it everywhere in the Bible. They don't see it in the Exodus. They don't see it in the prohibition against man-stealing, which means slave trading. That's clearly prohibited in the Bible. And yet, Paul was not going to think he's going to overturn this system in the Roman Empire any more than he was going to elevate women to the place that ultimately women were elevated in the New Testament churches, which is a full church member with no difference in our status before God. You know, part of the brethren, part of the brotherhood, sisterhood. I mean, you can't get away from patriarchal language. It's everywhere. But you know what I mean. Those are terms in the Bible that are true of men and women. Brethren. No longer Jew or Gentile. There's differences between Jews and Gentiles, but the differences are not paramount. Neither Jew nor Gentile, nor slave nor free. Certainly Paul knew there was a difference between the slave and the slave owner. What's the third one again? Jew or Gentile, slave and free. There's one more distinction there in Galatians chapter 3. It's just not hitting my brain. Anyway, the important thing is the unity we have in Christ. That's the important thing. That we're made one in Christ. We all stand before God on equal footing. So, that ought to change things within our attitudes of men to women, in terms of Jews to Gentiles, in terms of slave to free. That's the other one, male and female, slave and free, Jew and Gentile. The gospel changes our attitudes, and ultimately it changes the society when people come under the rule of Christ. I have gone far beyond our normal time. Forgive me for that. Let's briefly close in prayer. Father, we're thankful for this time in your word. Pray that your blessing would be upon your people as we consider these things. Give us understanding in them as we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.